Today on Against the Grain, if you think the collection and selling of personal data began in the last 20 years, think again. Consumer credit agencies like Equifax have been gathering information about people's intimate details since they were created in the late 19th century. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with scholar Josh Lauer about the history of credit agencies, their key role in capitalist consumer culture, and why we shouldn't expect them to look out for consumers. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The widespread gathering of our private information may seem like the invention of late capitalism, of entities like Facebook and Google, or in fact, by the state. But such surveillance is not new, and the trail was blazed by private consumer credit agencies like Experian, TransUnion, and Equifax, whose lack of adequate defenses has led to the breach of the private information of approximately 143 million Americans. In Josh Lauer's book, Creditworthy, A History of Consumer Surveillance and Financial Identity in America, the author examines how credit surveillance seeks to make consumers obedient, predictable, and profitable. Lauer is Associate Professor of Media Studies at the University of New Hampshire and joins me today. As I've just noted, Josh, surveillance and the gathering of data seem very modern. And when we think about surveillance, the image of the government looking over our shoulder springs to mind. But you argue that the history of credit surveillance shows that it's not new, nor has the government been in the lead, but rather commercial entities.
Well, that's exactly right. My argument in the book, in part, is that the kinds of surveillance that we're under now, especially from private sector organizations like credit bureaus, is not new at all. It's not just about computers and databases and the internet. It really was record keeping with files beginning in the late 19th century for consumer credit bureaus. And the other point is that, you know, the federal government in the United States was not particularly well organized until, you know, the late 19th, early 20th century. It begins to consolidate and become something more powerful. And in many ways, these credit bureaus had more records and had deeper, more personal information than the information that state organizations had, especially in the United States.
Well, this is a question about the bigger picture, but they're connected. How should we understand the rise of consumer culture in the United States over the last two centuries, and what were the necessary ingredients? In some ways, we take it for granted that we live in this society that's very deeply engaged in consumption, but that didn't come fully formed.
That's true. And so I focus in particular on the credit aspect, consumer credit aspect. And one thing it's really worth pointing out is that consumer credit is not new either, not even close. And it's not a 20th century thing. During the 19th century and earlier, many, many Americans purchased things on time, and it's usually informal. So, you know, you agree to pay the local grocer or the tailor later, the doctor, you pay the doctor later. And there was no credit bureau, but you sort of had an agreement about how you would do it. Maybe the merchants would keep some ledger records of their own. But obviously, the country got bigger, more people were moving around, the geography expanded. And suddenly, a lot of retailers and merchants found that it was hard to figure out who they could trust. And so the credit economy was already there. But because society changed, these new institutions emerged to help merchants and retailers and other businesses that provided some credit services a way to identify people, to find out who was who, and then to keep track of how they paid their bills, if they paid their bills, so that they could, you know, collect them later or at least avoid people who might be sort of the worst risks.
And it would come as a surprise, I think, to quite a few listeners that the credit bureaus that are with us today, one of them engulfed in scandal right now, that they are not a very new phenomenon. In fact, have their roots to the early 20th and even late 19th century. Tell us about the importance of the Consumer Credit Bureau and how it emerged in the late 19th century.
Well, first, it's hard to imagine a modern credit economy without the credit bureaus. It's just inconceivable. We rely on them so heavily. that, and we take it for granted, frankly. The latest breach obviously gives us a window into exactly how much data they have, the implications of losing that data. But the credit bureaus really provide businesses with vital information so that they can give us instant credit. But these institutions have been around for a really long time, as you mentioned. So the first credit bureaus really emerged around New York City in around 1870, so shortly after the Civil War. And it was, you know, the perfect situation where you have a large city, lots of people moving around, lots of strangers, and you had merchants, grocers, butchers, tailors, doctors, all trying to, you know, manage credit relationships with people they really didn't know anymore. So these early bureaus emerged to help these businesses figure out that information, and they grew very quickly. They soon began to appear in cities and towns across the United States. By the turn of the 20th century, there were dozens of bureaus throughout the country, and then within another 10 or 20 years, there were hundreds of bureaus throughout the country. So they've really been around for a long time. And also, you know, you mentioned Equifax. Equifax, its original company was the retail credit company, and they were formed in the late 1890s. So Equifax has been around for more than 100 years.
So how did the credit bureaus get the information that they had? How did they gather the data, and then what would they do with it at the turn of the 20th century?
So one of the innovations of the credit bureau was to convince local merchants to share information about their customers with a central clearinghouse, which was the credit bureau. And a lot of these early credit bureaus formed as associations of retailers or business people in the local community. They were all organized locally, so it would be in one town or one city. They weren't national credit bureaus. And the information came directly from the retailers, the subscribers themselves. So, for example, department stores were really important in the development of early consumer credit bureaus because they had hundreds of customers that were strangers, you know, to the owners and to the people who were selling to them. And they relied on credit information from these bureaus to be able to decide who to give charge accounts to. So that, you know, the early history is really tied up in the consumer culture of department stores and also other merchants who were, you know, looking to try to address the problem of identifying people that they were going to be transacting with.
To what degree were credit bureaus and the credit parts of department stores, to what degree did they reflect the biases of the wider society in terms of who was credit worthy and who wasn't, both in terms of class, in terms of race, in terms of gender? What did you see there?
That's a great question. So for the most part, we have to assume that you know, there was a bias towards white and middle class buyers. There's not a lot of evidence in the historical record to say for sure exactly who was excluded and who was included. I mean, you can only infer that kind of information. And one of the problems is that none of these credit records survive. So it's not like you can go to an old credit bureau from the 1890s or an old department store credit department and look at their records. So we can only sort of infer what happened. But for the most part, we can infer that there was prejudice because when we look at things like the application forms that department stores used or credit bureaus used to collect information, they often included information about gender, marital status, both of which are prohibited from credit records now, but also race. Race was a big part of credit consideration, and also ethnicity. And so, you know, we can look into that and see very clearly that there was discrimination against non-white people and non-native-born Americans that might have been from, you know, Eastern Europe, for example.
Right. I mean, you write about the class profiling that someone might do in terms of deciding whether or not someone was creditworthy, depending on how well-dressed they were, how well-spoken they were, and often that actually might be the person who was about to take you for a ride.
Yeah, so the way that credit decisions were made up until the 1960s and 1970s is very different from how they're made now. Generally, you had a credit manager, a credit man, they were often called, even though many women worked in credit departments. So, for example, you would have a department store, and they would have a credit department in the store. And if you wanted to open a charge account, you had to sit down with the credit manager or one of his or her associates And the credit manager, the credit clerk, would take the application. You weren't allowed to fill out the application because the manager would do that and take notes about the person along the way. And of course, you know, one of the things that they were looking for is just, you know, your disposition, whether you seemed like an honest person, whether you seemed organized, whether you seemed like the kind of person that would be trustworthy. And those were the kinds of decisions that would be made on the ground by credit managers in stores and, you know, and later in banks when personal loans became more common. But that kind of decision making is completely taken away now by credit scoring, and it, you know, raises other kinds of problems.
Tell us about this notion of character and how it relates to the risk that credit agencies might undertake in terms of giving someone a loan.
So until the 1960s, the understanding of what creditworthiness consisted of among credit professionals were the three C's, character, capacity, and capital. Capital, obviously, the money that you have, capacity really related to your ability to earn a living, your job history. But character was considered sort of the foundation of creditworthiness. It was the most important of the three C's. And it referred to, you know, what we can imagine is your sense of honesty, your integrity, your willingness to repay a loan. And that, you know, that basically summed it up for lenders. It was really not necessarily a problem whether you had the means to pay a loan, because lots of people have the money to pay their debts and they choose not to for whatever reason. They might just be indifferent, especially during the late 19th century and the early 20th century. There was lots of discussion of the arrogant rich. So it became sort of common knowledge among credit managers and credit professionals that just because somebody was wealthy did not guarantee that they would pay at all. They might, you know, just completely blow off their obligations. And they discovered that people who may be coming with lesser means, working professionals or blue-collar workers who had steady employment, they could be more reliable and more trustworthy as credit customers than people who you would assume would have the money and would not evade their obligations. So it changed the way that consumer lenders thought about who they were going to deal with. And this idea of character was central to that because it really is democratic in a way. It's not necessarily about the amount of money you have in the bank. It's really about the kind of person you are, whether you are, you know, honest and hardworking and reliable.
Josh Lauer is my guest. He's Associate Professor of Media Studies at the University of New Hampshire. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. So you mentioned credit professionals, and one of the things that you talk about in your book, Creditworthy, is the rise of this class of credit professionals in the early 20th century who were deeply involved in not just making assessments about someone's creditworthiness, but even, as you've just been talking about, the kind of notions of how one would even get to that information, in effect, you know, something that they might have seen as a science. Can you explain that whole aspect of this story?
Sure. So during the late 19th century, many businesses, retailers, and again, department stores, but also large installment dealers, so selling furniture, pianos, things like that, they had credit relationships with their customers. And, you know, historically, the credit decisions were made by the owner of the store, or the, you know, the person who was in charge of selling. The customer would come in, the owner of the store would sort of look them up and down and decide whether or not to grant them some credit. But as business expanded and more people are involved, you begin to have experts who specialize in credit management within these stores. So the department store, again, is sort of the prototypical example. You have people in those stores who, you know, become expert in figuring out who to trust and who to give credit to and how to manage those accounts and keep those records. And they become known as credit men. Again, although there were credit women who were involved early in the 20th century, but they professionalize and they become sort of the motivational force behind the creation of credit bureaus. So the credit managers really start to instigate organizing throughout the country. They form their own credit men's associations, and they begin to correspond with each other, and they share information between cities. And eventually you have the beginning of, you know, what looks like a national consumer credit reporting network because of these credit professionals working both in their stores, providing information to local credit bureaus, which they've helped to establish, and then sharing that information among bureaus, you know, throughout the country.
One aspect of what these people have had to contend with, or part of the role of credit professionals, is not just understanding how to assess creditworthiness, but there's another aspect as well, which is whether or not someone has the means to pay. Someone might, but will they in fact pay? So how did they understand that other side of this question?
Well, that's really the crux of the matter. Like you said, it's not whether you have the means to pay, it's whether you're the kind of person who will pay. And the credit manager, these credit experts, credit men and credit women, became experts in looking at applicants and judging their creditworthiness, their risk, based on their conversation and the information they were collecting. And of course, some of that information, you know, was basic employment information, information about what assets they might have. But a big part of it was this idea of character. So, you know, if you were sitting down with someone and the credit manager thought, you know, you looked, you know, disheveled, or you looked like you, you know, were shifty and weren't trustworthy, that would work against you. That would be a problem. And it, you know, might result in some sort of discrimination against you.
One of the particularly interesting parts of this story is that it is part of a larger story about the production of personal information. Going before the 20th century, something that seems very late 20th and early 20th century to us, because obviously there are all sorts of businesses that emerged from the 90s that collect our data and then use them in different commercial ways. But you're arguing here that the production of personal information and the way that has been, in effect, commodified under capitalism is something that's been with us for quite a while. One of the things that was very striking to read was that as these credit bureaus, these credit professionals are generating all of this information about people in the early 20th century, that they had, as you alluded to at the beginning, more information in many ways about people than the government did. And that when the government or federal or local agencies needed data on people, say the FBI or local police, they would actually turn to credit bureaus. Can you talk about that aspect of this? What did people's data look like? How was it shared, you know, in that period of time?
So the information that was in credit files up until the 1960s was very different than it is today. Today, it's much more spare and compartmentalized to, you know, a few different categories of information that are relevant and legal. But before 1970, the credit bureau industry was almost completely unregulated. So you could have just about any information in a credit bureau file. So what kind of information was this? Well, of course, you know, the main information was how you paid your bills. So, you know, all the different stores in your town would report that you paid your bills on time, or you were a little slow, or you should ask for cash from this person. They would, you know, give balances and talk about how much the different kinds of accounts that you had with different merchants. But they also included information that would be picked up from neighbors, from employers, from landlords, clippings that might be in newspapers and magazines. So arrest records, if there were discussion of a person either having extramarital affairs, drinking too much, or being involved with drugs or with unsavory characters, that kind of information could end up in your credit file and also have consequences when you were, you know, trying to open an account later, finding that the credit bureau was reporting to local merchants that, you know, that maybe you were disreputable in a certain way that isn't directly related to creditworthiness, but something in your personal life.
So who exactly would be going around talking to your neighbors or your landlord or getting this information?
Often it would come through calls to neighbors or calls to landlords to find information about find out about the person that was living at that address. So especially this happened when there were new people who were coming into town, or if they were trying to find out something about a person that didn't have a record in the credit bureau, they might call the local grocer who was serving in that particular part of the neighborhood and ask questions about not just whether they paid, but what kind of person they were, you know, what was their reputation. Because really in the history of credit reporting, and it precedes consumer credit reporting, is the idea that your creditworthiness is really tied to your personal reputation. And the credit bureaus begin to detach that sort of personal reputation element in and make it institutionalized, and they, you know, translate that into records. But there's still this element hanging behind that your creditworthiness is related to your reputation. And one of the arguments I make in the book is that creditworthiness is still a moral category. We think today that, you know, creditworthiness is really about credit scores and data, and it's, you know, very objective and neutral. But ultimately, you know, your credit score can be used to make assumptions about the kind of person that you are. So, you know, when you watch television and you see advertisements for credit repair services or credit monitoring services, you often see, you know, sort of young, immature people depicted as the people who have no clue what their credit score is, and they're sort of fumbling around. And the people who are responsible are the ones who have are paying attention to their credit scores. And really, the upshot is that, you know, the kind of person who, you know, is irresponsible and is not paying attention to their finances and is immature is, you know, a person who has a poor credit rating and lacks the, you know, the maturity and the morality of someone with a better credit record.
So did that morality come to play in the willingness of people, neighbors, for example, landlords, to disclose information about other people? Because obviously privacy and the way that people's private information has become more accessible has changed over time, over the 20th century into the 21st century. But I would wonder if, in the early 20th century anyway, some people would bristle at getting a call from some private company asking information on their neighbor.
Yes. I mean, when credit bureau investigators were trying to find information, they often use some element of subterfuge or, you know, deflection to get information, because not everyone was going to be happy about talking about their neighbor, and especially if they like their neighbor. But the credit bureaus, you know, were pretty resourceful. They didn't just rely on talking to neighbors. They also were constantly scanning every kind of publication that you can imagine. And they were going to the courthouse and collecting municipal records at all times, too. So not just police records, but records that might have to bearing on whether you have liens or other sorts of legal entanglements. The credit bureaus also paid attention to professional directories. They looked at magazines. They looked at every conceivable source you can imagine. So when we, you know, when I look back at this history and I'm reading this, it, you know, it sounds, of course, a lot like the kind of big data vacuuming that we see today, where, you know, just about anything that could be vacuumed up and analyzed is vacuumed up and analyzed by credit bureau officials. It's just that, you know, it's not computer data, but they're collecting all this information and they're putting it into their files and they hold on to it forever. So, you know, if you if there's a story in the newspaper about you getting arrested, even if the charges were dropped, that clipping would probably be in your file or could be in your file. And, you know, 20 years hence, that could have some bearing on, you know, a credit application that you might be submitting.
Well, let me ask you a question about the bigger picture, because you're just making the point that this gathering of big data is not just something from our moment, that actually has been going on for at least over the last century and a half, maybe longer. And you make the argument in your book, Creditworthy, that there has been a history of capitalism and modernity being connected with surveillance. Obviously, there's different kinds of surveillance, and here you're talking about consumer, private sector surveillance, but why is there the connection?
Well, I think, you know, for people who study or are interested in the history of surveillance, it's often thought of as being a development of the state. So, you know, governments are collecting information and developing their own bureaucracies. And that's, you know, the conventional focus when we think about the development of modern surveillance. But what I'm trying to argue is that in the private sector, there were companies and organizations like credit bureaus that were doing the same thing. And one of the things that was really striking about credit reporting, especially during the late 19th century and even a little earlier, is that they were doing something that other companies had really never done before. They were selling information. And this was, you know, striking to people even at the time, because this is an era where people are thinking about businesses as making things. They're producing things, whether they're cars or steel or something else, some other product. And the credit bureaus weren't producing anything tangible. They were only producing information. And they were selling information. So they're, you know, one of the first firms to actually take personal information to commodify it, and then to repackage it and sell it to the business community. And another thing that, you know, I would just point out is that the credit bureaus were primarily engaged in selling credit information. But remember, they had these files that are full of this deeply personal information about your home relationships, your marital status, your psychological status, your reputation in the community. So they also, in some cases, sold reports to prospective employers, people who are looking for jobs. They might get a call. The employer, prospective employer, might call the credit bureau for information, and also for insurance and for landlords. Landlords would call in and look for information about people, and they had specialized reports for insurance companies and for for landlords and for employers. So it wasn't just credit information. And when we look at the contemporary definition of what a consumer report is in the United States, it still includes appropriate uses for employers and for landlords. And in some ways, this might seem strange that, you know, we're talking about credit. What is employment? You know, what do landlords have to do with that? And it's a legacy from over 100 years when the credit bureau was selling these other services using the same kinds of information that they had in their files to monetize data that they had in their possession.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the author of Creditworthy, A History of Consumer Surveillance and Financial Identity in America. That's published by Columbia University Press, and its author is Josh Lauer. He's Associate Professor of Media Studies at the University of New Hampshire. So you've been talking about the collecting and selling of deeply personal information in the earlier 20th century. When we think of the collection of data, when we think of the transmission of data, we think about computers. And I want to ask you about how computers affected the collection and selling of data to do with credit. But first, I'd like to ask you about the technology before computers. How did these entities store information and transmit information before the computer?
That's a great question. So some of the earliest credit bureaus published rating books. And so these look like city directories, thick books, and they have the names and addresses and employment, the job description of all the different people who lived in the community, again, usually a city or a town, and then had some numbers and letters in many cases sort of representing their creditworthiness, whether they could be trusted a little bit or a lot or not much, or if you want more information, you should call us and we'll investigate. So it's, pretty crude in terms of what we might call credit ratings. And that's how they started. But eventually they shifted over to communicating the information by telephone because the credit rating books, they get published and they go out of date quickly. So most of the credit bureaus, especially in the early part of the 20th century, throughout the first half of the 20th century, up into the 1960s. It's basically a giant room filled with filing cabinets, and you have telephone operators, usually women, attached to telephone banks, and they're just answering calls all day. The different stores or the banks, the fuel dealers, hospitals, insurance companies are calling in and asking about a particular person. And the operator on the other end is, putting them on hold and quickly grabbing the file out of the filing cabinet and then giving them a report or giving them the relevant information that they would like. And that's the way it operated up until the 1960s and even later. And computers really didn't become a factor until the middle of the 1960s and after.
So what happened in the 1960s? It seems like that was a watershed moment in some ways, because you had technological change and also some scrutiny which these consumer credit bureaus really had escaped up until that point.
Exactly. So during the middle of the 1960s, the first organizations started to computerize their credit records. And it didn't happen right away, but a few big organizations that had a lot of capital could invest in the new technology, which is quite expensive and complicated to program and to organize. And over the next 10, 15 years, these a handful of major organizations, companies, started to computerize and buy out all of the other local bureaus throughout the country. So during the late 1960s, there were over 2,000 credit bureaus throughout the United States. They were often multiple credit bureaus in the same city. So, for example, in San Francisco, there were more than 20 different credit bureaus. If you were trying to get credit information about a new customer, you would have to call more than one credit bureau and maybe a lot of credit bureaus to make sure you had the complete information. So when the bureaus start to computerize, all of these little bureaus are purchased and the industry began to consolidate. So by the 1980s, you had five major consumer credit bureaus that were computerized. And then shortly after that, you had had it winnowed down to three, and they're the three that we have today.
And then in terms of regulation, how did these credit bureaus end up being held to account, at least to some degree, more than they had been up until then, which was almost nothing?
It was almost by accident. So in the middle of the 1960s, at the same time that the first credit bureaus began to computerize, there was a proposal at the federal government level to create a federal data center. And this data center was going to include Census Bureau data and other economic statistical data that was going to be used by social scientists for their own analysis. But it caught the attention of congressmen, and they got very upset because in the middle of the 1960s, the idea of a centralized government database freaked them out. And so they had a hearing, and they brought in a bunch of experts and some computer scientists and started asking about the dangers of a centralized computing system. And in the process, one of these computer scientists mentioned that, well, you know, you're worried about the government, but there are already private organizations that are doing this, like insurance companies, airlines, and credit bureaus. And when that information came out, I think the lawmakers were shocked. And soon after that, you had the first Consumer Credit Bureau hearings. And in the process of these hearings, a lot of information came out about, you know, the kinds of information that was in credit files and the kind of power that credit bureaus had in people's lives. And it ultimately led to some new regulations with the Fair Credit Reporting Act in 1970. But even at that time, most credit bureaus were not computerized. They were still paper-based credit bureaus. And it was just by accident that the government or the lawmakers, rather, discovered that the computers were even a problem and then intervened and addressed some other problems that didn't necessarily have to do with computers directly.
How extensive were those regulations, and how did they fit into wider concerns at the time around privacy?
Well, it's interesting because the credit bureau industry was really, you know, one of the first and only industries to be regulated in the context of privacy. I mean, that was the beginning of the battle for privacy in general, but for consumer privacy in particular. And since 1970, it's just been a battle. Consumer advocates have been trying to claw their way against the invasions of privacy and the abuses of information that not just credit bureaus, but you know, businesses in general, had the power to exercise over consumers. Initially, credit bureaus still would not give consumers access to their own credit report. So even after the Fair Credit Reporting Act was passed, you couldn't go to a credit bureau and say, I'd like to see my file. That was denied to consumers. And so they had to go back and fight some more for that to have access to a credit report. And then for years, if you wanted to see your credit report, you had to buy it. And it's only fairly recent that that consumers are allowed or entitled to at least one free copy per year so they can review their credit information. So the larger point is that even though some aspects of credit reports were regulated so that you couldn't have the kinds of information that was in credit files before, and they set limits on how long certain pieces of information could stay in a credit file, for example, bankruptcies. But it's still an ongoing battle for consumers to have some sense of access and transparency and recourse when it comes to credit files. And of course, the latest Equifax hack is, bringing all of that to light now.
Right. And I do want to ask you, and we'll ask you about the state of regulation or lack thereof now. But I wanted to ask you about how credit scores emerged and how an agreement on some sort of uniform way of assessing people's credit worthiness. How did that develop, and how has that changed in more recent times?
That's a fascinating story all to itself. So the first statistical credit scoring systems emerged in the late 1950s, early 1960s, and the pioneers of that kind of credit scoring come from Fair Isaac. And they developed these models using credit applications. So they weren't using credit bureau data at all. They would basically take applications for credit. So if you're applying for a bank loan, they would take the application and then they would take the variables on the application and weigh them and put them into the model and come up with a credit score. But what's interesting about this is that when credit scoring was first introduced, credit managers that we talked about, these professionals, did not like them at all. They resisted them. They thought that the models didn't make any sense because you couldn't judge character through the credit model. You couldn't meet with a credit applicant and talk to them and get some context and actually, you know, use your interpersonal skills as a credit manager to assess their trustworthiness. So the credit professionals actively resisted credit scoring for years and years and years. And it wasn't really until the Equal Credit Opportunity Act was passed in 1976 that credit scoring began to get accepted. And the reason it got accepted was because this new regulation punished companies, lenders, for discriminating, and they adopted credit scoring as a way to protect themselves against any charges that they might be discriminatory among credit applicants, because the credit score had distinct variables that you could, you know, defend and look at statistically and, you know, make an argument that, you know, you weren't discriminating.
How did this credit scoring evolve as more data became available about people in the 1990s and through to the present? Did that change the way that credit risk was scored?
Yeah, absolutely. So initially, you know, the credit scores were used just to figure out whether or not a person should get a loan or, you know, get a credit card. They were just used to help get through the initial hurdle of acceptance. But it quickly became apparent that you could use different models to make other predictions. For example, about the profitability of a credit card customer over time. Based on different data points, you could predict whether, not only whether the person was creditworthy, but if they took the card, how much would they use it? How much profit would they generate over a lifetime? You know, how much could you expect to earn in interest from them? Because, you know, for example, in the credit card industry, a person who is paying off their balance every month is not very profitable. You really want people to run up some debt, you know, have interest charges, but not so much that they're going to end up defaulting and being another kind of problem. But the other way that credit scoring became really important and revolutionary in some good and bad ways is that it was used to set interest rates. So it wasn't just a matter of, yes, you could have a credit card and our standard interest rate is 17%, but you could charge a lot more interest for people who seem to be at a higher risk and, you know, less, give the nicer offers to people who seem to be the safer risks. But basically, credit scoring opens the door to the idea of subprime lending.
And what is the relationship between credit bureaus and lenders now?
Well, the lenders are very dependent on credit bureau information to make credit decisions. And I might have mentioned earlier, I mean, it's hard to imagine the modern credit economy without credit bureaus. And this is especially true when we think about digital commerce and the use of credit cards in particular. If the banks could not rely on credit bureau data to keep track of how people made payments and the kinds of debt that they had, they wouldn't be able to offer credit cards the way they do. They wouldn't be able to offer loans the way they do.
Obviously, for some people, a lot of it may feel predatory as well. I mean, that credit card companies will offer people deals that then change and they kind of get themselves entangled in what they can't manage to pay off. And I guess part of my question is, to what degree do you think the credit bureaus are complicit in that?
Well, I mean, I don't know that the credit bureaus are complicit, but they certainly provide the information that allow predatory lenders to do what they do. So the other thing I would, you know, point out is, not only do you have credit scoring models models that can judge profitability, but the credit bureaus also sell marketing and segmentation models to different businesses. So, you know, it's certainly conceivable that a predatory lender can use credit bureau data to identify people with marginal credit scores and other demographic, socio-demographic attributes that might put them in a position of really needing or being susceptible to accepting the kind of offer that you're describing.
I'm speaking with Josh Lauer. He's Associate Professor of Media Studies at the University of New Hampshire. We're discussing his book, Creditworthy. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, in the time we have remaining, I'd like to talk about the leak of an enormous amount of personal data of millions of Americans from one of the three main credit bureaus, Equifax. Can you just start off by telling us how significant you think the hacking is in terms of just sort of scale and scope?
Well, obviously the scale is enormous. 143 million people may have data that could affect them and affect their creditworthiness and affect their financial identities. And I think, you know, a couple of things jump out. And one is just the enormous amount of power that credit bureaus have in our lives, not just, you know, in contributing to credit decisions or employment and that sort of thing, but just the amount of data they have. And they have, you know, the good stuff or the bad stuff, depending on who you're talking to. They have our social security number and our date of birth and, you know, all these other pieces of information that could be used to, you know, steal our identities. So they have a tremendous amount of responsibility. And the other thing I would say is that, you know, the problem with this particular hack and with, you know, with credit bureaus more generally is that if you're unhappy with them, you know, if Equifax lets us down and can't be trusted, it's not like if Target loses your data and you get mad at Target and say, well, you know what, I'm not going to shop at Target anymore if I can't trust you with my data. The three credit bureaus are the only game in town, and you don't opt into credit reporting. It's automatic if you have any sort of credit account. So the larger problem is that, you know, we can complain about it and we can demand changes and new regulations, but ultimately we can't do a whole lot about leaving the credit bureaus. We don't have any choice about that.
Right. I mean, they're collecting our very personal data without our consent, in effect.
That's true. But again, I mean, it's double-sided because, you know, there are benefits from having a single or a couple of organizations collect that information. So if it were done appropriately and safely and using guidelines that we agree, are fair and just for the people whose data they have, then that's fine. But the problem is that, you know, the data is apparently not secure. And also, we don't have the kind of transparency with the credit bureaus that we should have in terms of understanding what kinds of data they have, how the data is used, and who they're selling it to.
So in the wake of this massive breach of data from one of the three credit bureaus, Equifax, one of the things that's striking in your book is that those credit professionals who've worked for credit bureaus in the 20th century remarked regularly that consumers really had no idea of the scope of surveillance, the power of consumer credit bureaus over their lives, the kind of amount of data that was collected about consumers. And now credit bureaus, consumer credit bureaus, are in the spotlight after a very long time flying under the radar. It turns out that they're less regulated than banks. There's a lot of outrage right now, not surprisingly, with this enormous amount of data that was stolen because Equifax didn't have enough safeguards against a hack. So consumer credit bureaus are in the spotlight. But to what degree do you imagine that the credit bureaus will really change after this? Because it sounds like what you're saying is in the past, although there have been attempts to regulate consumer credit bureaus, that the history is they've never been very sufficient.
Well, I hope that this will instigate changes or at least efforts to introduce new kinds of regulation to make the whole process safer and fairer. But the history is not necessarily very encouraging. So Americans have a long record of not paying enough attention to credit bureaus. But what's sort of ironic about it is that for much of the 20th century, the credit bureau industry tried really, really hard to publicize their role in the American economy. So I write about in the book how credit bureaus used to participate in big parades in their cities. And one example, there was a float, and the credit bureau had a replica filing cabinet on their float with a big sign that said, you know, your record is in here. You know, we know about your identity. You know, really advertising that credit bureaus are out there and they're collecting your information and that you should know about it. And even in the 1950s, they participated in getting a big Life magazine story about credit bureaus that, you know, in retrospect, makes them look terrible. Talking about the kinds of information they were collecting and sort of boasting about the level of detail and of the personal information they were collecting. But they were really caught off guard in the late 1960s when all of a sudden everyone was really worried about privacy, and they, you know, became sort of the scapegoat in some ways for, you know, the a changing society in terms of new computers and new systems of data collection. And since the 1960s, they've really sort of retreated, and they have not, they've tried to, I think, steer clear of that kind of controversy, and they've been very wary. And in some ways, you know, the lack of knowledge about credit bureaus now is, you know, in part because they don't want to be front and center anymore. They do want to be working in the background, and that's very different than how they were, you know, even 40 years ago.
Well, if we can't, as you say, just abandon Equifax or any of the other ones out of frustration that they're not protecting our data, what options are there? Sounds like you're saying they could be more regulated, but it's not clear if that would be enough.
It's really difficult because, you know, not only are they powerful in terms of the data they have, but they're powerful as an industry. And, you know, ever since there have been efforts to regulate them, they've pushed back vigorously. And it's, you know, it's been consumers fighting tooth and nail just to get, you know, access to their credit reports, to get free copies. But, you know, it's a big problem. And, you know, another thing that I would point out is that the credit bureaus really are not designed to serve consumers. They were designed to serve business. Their whole reason for existence is to help businesses know something about the identities, the reputations, and the creditworthiness of people that they might be transacting with. And it's only more recently, you know, certainly after the Fair Credit Reporting Act, that credit bureaus have been pushed into more of a consumer-oriented role where they, you know, are forced to accommodate consumers and to give them information. And, you know, unfortunately, in some ways, you know, that change has given credit bureaus an opportunity to use their data to sell services to consumers that maybe we shouldn't have to pay for at all, for example, free credit monitoring services.
Given the vast scope of the data breach of Equifax, do you have any sense of how that will now change the future of credit assessments, given that now so much of Americans' personal information is now out there? I mean, is there any way of having a sense of what the future holds?
Well, that's the big open question that everyone's worried about. I mean, because all of this data has been stolen, it's not clear how it'll be used. You know, maybe it won't be used by criminals, and maybe it's just out there and there's not a whole lot to worry about. I mean, I think it's unlikely that 143 million people will have their identities stolen. But at the same time, it's really difficult because there isn't a whole lot you can do. I mean, of course, you can freeze your credit, and that's, you know, something a lot of people have been recommending. But, you know, that's an inconvenience. That means that you have to continuously, you know, be freezing and unfreezing your credit record. You might have, and when you freeze your credit record, you're only stopping inquiries into your credit information. So there might be, you know, some context where you're not even aware that there's going to be a credit inquiry that may not be obvious to you, and that's an inconvenience that you would have to worry about freezing and unfreezing. So, you know, we're really left in a situation where we're still hugely dependent on the credit bureaus to be the kinds of companies that we can trust, and I'm not convinced that that's necessarily the case.
Right, and of course, the consequence of the data breach doesn't just potentially affect the credit of the people whose information has been stolen. You know, if their social security numbers are out there in the world, then obviously that gives other people access to all sorts of other parts of their personal information, such as, you know, medical records and so on.
Yes, that's a nightmare.
Yeah. It's a situation that a lot of people have faced individually, but now it looks like this is happening on a whole different scale.
It could. And, you know, the worst case scenario when someone has their financial identity stolen is not that, you know, they can't open, you know, a credit card account or something like that. It's that they can't get a job, or they can't rent an apartment, because some employers use credit information to do checks when they're hiring, and the same thing with landlords. And that was a big problem for a number of people after the financial crisis. And it was a story that came up over and over again, that people, you know, lost their jobs, they couldn't got behind a little bit on their bills, and then they couldn't get another job because their credit information was affected, or their credit reputation was affected, making them look like they were less than reputable in the eyes of prospective employers. So there can be cascading effects that, you know, that go through your life that extend beyond just credit and go into other dimensions. And, you know, certainly the idea that, you know, your Social Security number can be used to unlock other things like medical records is outside of the purview of a credit bureau. But, you know, unfortunately, in this case, it looks like that golden key to all this other personal information came from the credit bureau.
Let me end by asking you what recourse consumers have in terms of contesting inaccurate information that may be in their credit reports, since it does seem like all sorts of different kinds of information has populated these reports. And I know there was there have been lawsuits by a number of attorneys general about what are considered legitimate sources of information that could be gathered by credit agencies. But for those who have to deal with inaccurate information, is there really any recourse?
Yeah, I mean, it's a much better situation today than it was, you know, 20 years ago in terms of trying to communicate with the credit bureaus and to, you know, get your inaccuracies and errors in your file fixed. But like I mentioned before, the credit bureau, you know, historically is not oriented towards consumers at all. And I think that that history is evident in sort of the consumer unfriendliness of the bureau sometimes. When consumers try to explain that they, you know, this isn't who they are, this identity is not theirs, that these accounts aren't theirs, because the credit bureaus have sort of a natural wariness and suspicion towards consumers because their allegiance is to the business community, and their main concern is that, you know, somebody is trying to get one over on the credit bureau and on their creditors, rather than feeling more sympathy or empathy for consumers who, you know, have a legitimate problem.
Josh Lauer, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with the author of Creditworthy, A History of Consumer Surveillance and Financial Identity in America. That's published by Columbia University Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Josh Lauer is Associate Professor of Media Studies at the University of New Hampshire. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.